Hi, my name is Alena Ляшева. I host this podcast, Toulon Didn't Read. Here we meet contributors of Commons Journal to talk about their texts and more. At the beginning of this year, Commons started a special project, the Dialogues of Peripheries. The main idea of this project is to produce knowledge about global politics and economy, about war and security, but from the perspective of people living in peripheral countries and being affected by the so-called world leaders. Within the dialogues, we criticize the civilizational view of the future of countries like Ukraine. We search for commonalities and differences in the experiences of the left involved in anti-imperialist resistance all over the world. And finally, we found out more about the activists and researchers who have supported the Ukrainian resistance in India, Syria, or Sudan. Today, we'll be speaking with our editor, historian, and serviceman of the armed forces of Ukraine, Taras Bilous. Over the past year and a half, Taras has written many texts and given several interviews about Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. His article, published 2 weeks before the invasion, explained why an international UN peacekeeping mission should be sent to Ukraine. The first texts and interviews after the 24th of February were aimed at our English-speaking readers. Taras explained why is it so important to support the Ukrainian resistance. The idea that formed the basis of the Dialogues of Peripheries often appears in his analysis. It's the idea that the world should not be divided into spheres of influence between the so-called big players, because this not only leads to the division of people into categories, but also strengthens conservative sentiments worldwide. That's why we've decided to talk to Taras about the Dialogues of Peripheries. Hello, Taras.
Привет, Алена.
Hello, Алена.
Could you tell us why during the full-scale invasion we came up with this idea to speak on the situation in the countries of the global periphery? And why should we be concerned about the situation in Lebanon or Brazil?
In Ukraine, the political discourse in general is, let's say, very Eurocentric, and at least since Euromaidan, all this rhetoric about European values, movement towards Europe, etc., etc., it dominates as if there is nothing beyond that. This problem existed before, but now it has become more acute. Now, even for purely pragmatic reasons, we need support not only from the West, despite the fact that they are the main suppliers of weapons for Ukraine, and we also rely on them financially. But we also need the support of other countries. And it is no coincidence that Russia is trying to use the countries of the Global South in order to bypass international isolation and sanctions. That is, economically, they attempt to minimize the negative impact of sanctions by expanding cooperation with the countries of the Global South. And politically and symbolically, they are trying to show that, oh no, we're not isolated. They use this pseudo-anti-colonial, anti-Western rhetoric to gain support in the Global South. Okay, that's about Russia. In our country, unfortunately, for a very long time, the state, civil society, and intellectuals did not pay attention to the Global South. Everything revolved around the idea that we are moving towards Europe, we are defending European values. You and I were both already fed up with this rhetoric 8 years ago. And now, well, finally, during the war, the state and certain intellectuals, as well as the public, began to realize that it is necessary to pay attention to the Global South. In fact, besides us, there are other organizations and groups that are currently doing different projects about the Global South, traveling with delegations, and the state has begun to open new embassies and appoint ambassadors in places where they hadn't been able to do it for a very long time. So thank God there is some understanding now. To us, those things were obvious, because for us, in addition to pragmatic aspects, there are also moral and political ones. And it is obvious that any global left project has to pay a lot of attention to these countries. Ukrainians now complain a lot about how our opinion is neglected, how we're not given enough attention. But have Ukrainians themselves paid much attention to wars in other countries? And what are their attitudes towards these other countries?
But one may say that the countries of Latin America do not want to support us. So why should we support them and open embassies there?
And they can respond, and many actually do respond, well, those Ukrainians are pro-Western, pro-American, and the West colonized us, the US staged coups for decades, so why should we care about them? This is the very same false logic which prevents solidarity between the oppressed in different countries. It prevents mutual understanding between the victims of different imperialisms. The idea that everyone there is pro-Russian is false too. In reality, the situation differs from country to country. The concept Global South is so broad, I'm not even sure it makes much sense.
Mm-hmm. And what is a periphery? In many Marxist works, we come across interpretations of this concept, which suggests that Russia is also a periphery, while the United States are the real imperialists.
And for peripherality, yes, we can look at the world through the prism of world system theory. There is the core of the capitalist system, let's say the West, and there are the semi-periphery and the periphery. This describes the empirical reality to some extent. But even within this framework, certain regions such as Northern Eurasia or, for instance, Eastern Europe, they've got their own peripheries and semi-peripheries. So Eastern European countries are in a unique position when, on the one hand, they are the periphery of the semi-peripheral empire, while on the other hand, they are closer to the West than the core of this empire. The public discourse is currently dominated by the representation of Ukraine as a colony, although in reality things were more complicated. In fact, in the Russian Empire, different parts of modern Ukraine had different statuses. And on the one hand, we were a colony, but on the other hand, we were part of the empire's core in some respects.
To me, the most interesting publication within the dialogues was probably my conversation with Joy. He's an activist from Lebanon who writes a lot about Lebanon, Syria, Israel, and Palestine. In his texts and podcast, he looks for such points of contact between people from different peripheral countries and explains how they can unite against different imperialists. Which publications are your favorite?
I'd like to mention the article by Chelsea Nguyen, a Vietnamese-Indonesian author. In the article, she criticized the approach of Ukrainian diplomacy in the Global South. Many statements of our diplomats were simply counterproductive and rather worsened relations with those countries and the attitudes of the people towards Ukraine. It's a very important article because those issues should have been discussed long ago. And it's a problem not only diplomats have. We came up with the idea of the article after criticizing Volodymyr Yermolenko on Twitter. The Ukrainian philosopher wrote about Russia and its past, and he claimed that Russia's becoming Asian. Well, in our context, Asian is often used as backward, authoritarian, and so on. But for people living there, those fighting for freedom, justice, and equality, such use of the word is offensive, to put it mildly. That was probably the first time Volodymyr Yermolenko faced canceling on Twitter. Eventually, he had to delete that thread and apologize. And I then thought it would be nice to offer Chelsea to write an article elaborating on her critique. This example, as well as other examples she brings up, such as when the ambassador of Ukraine in Indonesia spoke favorably of Indonesia's anti-communist policy in the 20th century, which led to the murder of millions of people.
Let's not spoil the article and encourage our listeners to find and read it.
Okay, I would also add that last spring, Joya Ayoub moderated our discussion with Syrian activists Yassin Al-Hajsaleh and Wafa Ali Mustafa. From Ukraine, there were Yulia Yurchenko and I. That's when I found out about Joy and started following him on Twitter and became familiar with their environment in general. So this also has to do with the heterogeneity of the Global South. Because Syrian anti-Assad activists, supporters of the Syrian revolution, they are indeed one of our most ardent supporters in the Global South. And there's really no need to explain anything. We're on the same page with them. They support us and believe in us because we have a common enemy.
I'd like to provoke you a bit with the next question. Will we find an opportunity for a dialogue between Ukrainians and, for example, people from Latin American countries? How should we talk to people who are directly experiencing the consequences of the imperialist policy of the United States? And why should they support Ukraine while we rely on US support in fighting Russia?
Honestly, you ask how we should talk to them, and I don't know. With Syrians, it was easy. In my first letter to the Western left, at the very beginning of the invasion, I quoted a Syrian activist, Leila Al-Shami, and Syrians then started tagging me on Twitter. I mean, it was easy to find common ground with them. But later I published an article titled The War in Ukraine, Global South. That was rather a response to the rhetoric of the Western left and specifically the leaders of the Progressive International, which we commons left shortly after. But I tried to speak to the people from the Global South as well. And while my previous speech to the Western left reached a wide audience, this article did not. Well, it had some readers in the West, but in the Global South, as far as I can tell, it didn't get any attention. Now I see that I should have emphasized other things in that paper. Well, the text is not that bad, but if I were writing it today, it would come out completely different.
So what would be your arguments now?
Well, I would emphasize that it wasn't us who colonized them. One of the problems is that Ukraine is perceived as part of the West, part of Europe, and for those people, Europe means colonizers, those who exploited them. And this is why this rhetoric that we're the stronghold of Europe against the Eastern barbarians is so screwed up, and not-to-do list could be written based on those statements. Of course, we mostly receive aid from the West, and in this respect, this rhetoric helped us gain more support. But we should not overestimate this support either. And well, it seems to me that Ukrainians these days are bigger fans of this imagined Europe than citizens of EU countries. The latter have deconstructed this concept long ago, and they are rather skeptical about it now. In the US, they've also deconstructed the concept of the West and begun to discuss their own imperialist past. So, if we, and by we I mean Ukrainian authorities and, let's say, civil society, slowed down a little and used the pro-Western rhetoric a little bit less, it would not undermine the support of Europe and North America. There is nothing to be afraid of. But at the same time, it would help to engage in a dialogue with the Global South, because there is a need to talk and explain that we didn't colonize you guys. And rhetoric, that's the easiest. Then we've got the state's political direction, and that's where the problems begin. Our foreign policy is aimed at accession to the EU and NATO. Now, NATO is a particular sore point. Again, in the Global South, they see it as, oh, you want to join an imperialist military alliance, which used to bomb this and that and other countries here. The US invaded Iraq. Now the country is a mess. There's Islamic State because of them and so on. And yeah, it wasn't NATO that invaded Iraq, but an international coalition. France and Germany were against the invasion back then, and thanks to their position, NATO as an organization didn't directly take part in it. So besides rhetoric, there are objective, let's put it that way, circumstances and foreign policy of our government, which will hinder this dialogue. But nevertheless, we have to try.
I'd also like to talk about your article, which was not included in the special project, because you'd written it before we started the Dialogues of Peripheries. In the article, you brought up one of the main topics we deal with now. In the article, The Tragedy of Eastern Europe, you criticize the division of the world into spheres of influence. Could you tell us what it is and what's wrong with this approach?
What is it? Well, after I wrote the article, I realized there was a problem. This term, sphere of influence, has two different meanings. One, it's when an area is literally controlled by or is under the heavy political influence of an imperialist state. The other, the definition I was using, it's when several imperialist states kind of divide the world, a country or a region, into spheres of influence, agreeing that, okay, here you can do whatever you like, and here we'll be doing whatever we like, and let's not get in each other's way. Later, after some discussions that followed the publication, I thought, well, maybe I should have used the term spheres of interests. Anyway, even though the phrase sphere of influence is used today as the sphere of the dominant influence of a large state, historically it was rather used to describe a situation when large states are dividing continents or countries among themselves. Reading your questions for this podcast, I was like, what was the very first example of this? And I realized it was probably at the very beginning of the so-called Age of Discovery, at the end of the 15th century. Just after America was discovered by Columbus, a conflict began between Portugal and Spain, and they came up with this idea to half the world. Everything to the west of a certain meridian, all newly discovered territories, would have been owned by Spain, and everything to the east by Portugal. It's interesting how they were dividing territories that weren't even discovered yet, let alone somehow controlled by them. But the term became widely used later, and it's important that, for instance, in the case of the Monroe Doctrine in the USA, although later the United States used the doctrine to justify its interventions in the affairs of Latin American countries, so it's important that when they were declaring the Western Hemisphere their sphere of influence, they said that the European powers were not to interfere in the affairs of those countries. That was, again, in the context of large states. But in that article, I wrote particularly about Eastern Europe without giving much attention to the Global South. I wrote about the division of Europe after the Second World War, and that's a different story, really. That's a story about how we should deal with the Soviet heritage, Stalinist heritage, etc. These are the aspects of the problem that are of most importance to us. But my argument was that when large states are negotiating, like, let's not interfere, this is our sphere of influence and that is yours, and let's not get in each other's way, this limits the opportunity for small countries and national liberation movements in these countries to somehow use the disagreements between large states in their interest. One of the problems we faced when dealing with the Western left is that they often regard our war as just a struggle between different geopolitical powers, while ignoring the agency of people who live here, of these countries and local social movements. And the concept of spheres of influence, defined as this division among large states, is also important here because this is actually what Russia wanted before the invasion. It's what Russia had been demanding from the USA for ages, to recognize certain region or countries as Russia's sphere of influence and not interfere in whatever they were about to do here. In particular, that ultimatum Russia gave the US and NATO at the end of 2021 about, you know, an agreement that Ukraine would never join NATO, etc., etc., it was basically a demand to divide spheres of influence. And again, it looks like some Western leftists believe that if the US agreed to this, it would bring peace. but we know it wouldn't. What it would do is worsen the situation, and we still need to figure out how to communicate this idea to them. This is not about the Global South in the first place, but it's about the dialects of peripheries. We're not only explaining the Global South to Ukrainian audience, we're also trying to do the opposite, to talk to the people from countries in the Global South about us and our region and some aspects of it they might know little about.
Indeed, when we look at the world from the perspective of the spheres of influence, there is no space for us, you, me, and millions of Ukrainians. But if we reject this kind of approach, what lens should we choose instead so we are visible?
In that article, I touched upon how the UN was established. Initially, it was supposed to bring the spheres of influence to an end, as well as colonialism. Some may laugh at how I keep mentioning the United Nations, because Ukrainians these days tend to say that it's such a useless organization, and people from other countries that went or are going through war, Syrians, for instance, have their issues with the UN too. But the problem is, when I ask, okay, what's our alternative, I don't hear anything realistic. Clearly, the UN is a terrible organization. It's ineffective, it's unjust, because Russia and four other members of its Security Council have a privileged position and veto power. Clearly, the UN is crying out for reforms. And while reforming it doesn't seem easy and realistic, it's still easier than building something from scratch. There will be a chance to build something from scratch only after another world war, which I hope won't be the case. Even Zelensky, in his speech at the meeting of the UN Security Council, spoke about the need to reform the UN. I believe it's really important. And this reform is a problem countries of the Global South have been speaking on for decades, especially countries in Africa. For the Global North, the UN is not that important. They have NATO to guarantee their security, so they basically don't care about the UN, plus they are rich. Countries of the Global South, on the other hand, are extremely underrepresented, considering, for instance, how many countries there are in Africa and how big the population is. And they have few places in the UN Security Council, even though it mostly deals with conflicts in Africa. They don't have a voice even in matters that directly affect them. So they often say that the UN has to be reformed. Now, let's not forget that the Russian war and wars in general aren't the only problem in the world. The climate catastrophe is looming over us, and with all the criticism of green capitalism, I haven't seen realistic proposals from the left on how we can solve this problem. We can speak about a world revolution, but it's also quite abstract and unrealistic, let's be honest. Degrowth, okay, but what will it look like? The thing is that to prevent an environmental disaster, we need a global structure, which will, among other things, coordinate global efforts, as well as ensure global redistribution between the North and the South. We just don't have time and resources to risk, like, oh, shall we create something new? Despite all the UN's shortcomings, our best option is to reform it. And while it must be criticized, the criticism should be aimed at changing this tool, not abandoning it. So far, my hopes have not come true, but still, I believe this is one of the topics that will help us find common ground with the Global South, with African countries and also countries of Latin America and Asia. China also has veto power in the UN, so they are not interested in reforms. But other countries are, and many people there understand why the UN has to be reformed. I believe we have to do our best to find common ground with them and to establish coordination and global efforts in order to force those in power to reform this senseless organization.
Thank you, Taras. Bye.
Bye.
Дякую, бувай.
This was the Too Long Didn't Read podcast by Commons Journal and its host Alena Ляшева. Today we're discussing the dialogues of peripheries with Taras Belous. editor of our journal, historian and serviceman of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. Besides Dialogues of the Peripheries, our journal has various other projects and formats. Another podcast we've got for you is Ukraine Possible. It's a series of audio essays by Vitaly Atanasov about the history of our country over the last few decades, war-related problems and the future they shape. It's like a crash course on Ukraine, predominantly for our foreign audience. Listen to the first episode dedicated to the effects of war on environment. Subscribe and tell your friends to subscribe. The podcasts are available on different platforms. Check our website podcast section for the links. And there is really important project called There You See. This is social reportage about Ukrainians solidarizing, volunteering, loving and caring about each other and their villages and cities. We'll be uploading them to our YouTube channel. So watch, like and share. This was Alena Ляшева. Goodbye.